Welcome. Good morning, everybody. We're in the initial lessons on the book of Daniel that we're going through here in the class. And I think for our opening scripture reading, just for the sake of context, since we only covered 14 verses last week, I will read Daniel 1, verse 1 through 14 section that we talked about last week for context. And then as we go through the subsequent verses, I'll read those in little blocks as we go through the lesson. So let's begin with Daniel chapter 1, verse 1 for context. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hands, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding, discerning of knowledge, and who had the ability for serving the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. This is the first of three invasions by the king Nebuchadnezzar, and it was at this first invasion in 605 BC that Daniel was taken into exile in Babylon. Verse 5. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which the king drank. And he appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter his personal service. Now among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or wine, which the king drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord the king. He has appointed food for you and your drink, so why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then he would make me forfeit my head to the king." But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, this is a different person, "Please let your servants for 10 days be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let the appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them in this matter, and he tested them for 10 days. I think we stopped last week at the end of verse 14. A quick review. The southern kingdom of Judah is about to go under the next to the most serious level of discipline that God's bringing on them because of the disobedience of the nation, particularly under Manasseh. And the nation refused to repent. They were not living consistently with the laws, ordinances, and statutes of the Mosaic Covenant, and they're about to go under an increased, intense phase of discipline. The Chaldean general, who was soon to be king, Nebuchadnezzar, invaded Jerusalem, and he exiled Daniel and three of his friends, and other members perhaps of the royal family, to Babylon. Daniel and his friends then, when they arrived in Babylon, they were enrolled in a training program which was designed to last 3 years, in which they were to be trained in the language and culture of the Chaldean Empire. This involved really nothing other than brainwashing for these young boys. There was a goal here in this educational program, and that was to educate the Hebrew faith and the Hebrew culture out of these boys. At the end of the training, that would be 3 years out, the king himself said he would interview the boys, and he would select the ones who would then become part of his royal cabinet and serve him personally in the Chaldean government. So everything about this education process is designed to convert the Hebrew captives into Chaldeans. Two very important things that are focused on here: language and diet. With regard to language, the king begins by changing the names of the boys. You'll remember that Hebrew names all have theological significance to them. So by changing their name to Babylonian or Chaldean names, they were in effect trying to wipe out the former identities of these Hebrew boys. He also wanted to replace their spoken language of Hebrew with spoken Aramaic, which was designed with the ultimate goal to make these Hebrew boys think like Chaldeans. And then there's diet. That may seem rather trite to us, but another element of this ethnic change was the substitution of the king's Chaldean food for the food that the boys were accustomed to eating. This was particularly problematic for Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, because they were observant Jews. Whereas these other changes, the change of the name, the involvement in the Aramaic language, and so on, may have been undesirable to these boys, changing their diet was unacceptable. And it was at this point that Daniel draws a line in the sand, and he says, I'm going to refuse at this point to capitulate to the plan that the Chaldean king has put in place for his captives. The reason for this dietary change, the reason it impacted Daniel so seriously, is that it was contrary to the dietary laws of the Mosaic Covenant. Acceptable and unacceptable foods were prescribed by the Mosaic Law. To violate dietary laws rendered the person unclean. In Israel, there's this concept of ceremonial cleanness. Ceremonial cleanness was imperative if you were going to worship God. If you had, for example, accidentally touched a dead person, or in some way had become ceremonially unclean, then you did not have access to God until certain sacrifices and certain things had been performed. So to engage in this new diet was contrary to the law, and it would result in these boys being ceremonially unclean. Therefore, they would not have been able to worship in the way they were accustomed to do. Furthermore, and this may be even more serious, typically the meat that would have been served to them was meat that had been sacrificed to the Babylonian idols. When they would sacrifice an animal as part of their pagan worship, they would take the meat then, and that meat would be consumed. And there's a very good chance that the meat that was put in front of these boys was meat that had come straight from the pagan temple, from the sacrifices that had occurred there. So what Daniel does is he says, I'm not going to participate in this. And he suggests something that I think is quite reasonable. He says to his overseer, let's do a test. Give us 10 days in which you don't feed us the food the king has prescribed, but just give us vegetables, give us water. And then at the end of the 10 days, compare the way we look to the way the other boys look and make your own decision based on empirical evidence. So that's exactly what happened. We ended last week with the test being put in force, and today we're going to pick up and see what happened after that 10 days. At the end of the test, this overseer over the boys, we're going to look at Daniel. He's going to look at Daniel's friends and compare him to the other boys. So when we began our text today in verse 15, the 10-day test has expired, and now it's time to see what happened. So let's look at verses 15 and 16. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink, and he kept giving them vegetables. Tests usually elicit questions, and there are two questions that I think come to mind at this point in the story. The first question is this: why should Daniel obey God when God has just let Jerusalem fall to the Chaldeans? If he's abandoned us, why should we not abandon him? And the second question is a little more general. What happens to believers who are put in place to live in a pagan culture? Are they responsible to remain true to the Hebrew faith and culture? Or should they capitulate to the culture into which God has placed them? Well, verse 2 already has hinted at the answer to the first question. We read in verse 2 of chapter 1, it was the Lord who gave Jerusalem and her king into the hand of the Chaldean general. Now that's important, because if God gave them over to the Chaldeans, that means God's still in control. If God's plan isn't considered, if you just look at this from a human viewpoint, then the Chaldeans won this war fair and square. The Jewish army lost. Therefore, the jig's up. That's how a human being would look at and interpret these circumstances. And the conclusion might very well be, then why obey? But if what happened to these Judeans, if what happened to Daniel and his friends is part of a bigger divine plan, if in fact God did indeed give them over to the Babylonians or the Chaldeans, then God's still in control, and the Judeans are still responsible to obey the covenant. It's really that simple. In fact, God is at work. He's at work through discipline to bring Judah in the form of a faithful remnant back into good favor and eventually bring them back into covenant land, even though they are exiled at the moment. As for the second question, God has providentially granted favor to Daniel with his overseers. They like him. They see a lot of potential in him. They are essentially, to the extent possible, treating him well. And this is done for a purpose. It's to give us insight into how believers are to live in a pagan society. Rather than harming his faith, the more Daniel learned about the Babylonian culture, the more committed he became to Yahweh and his law. I understand this, because the more I observe and think about our culture, the more I see the direction that we're going and how it is shaping up exactly as God told us in Scripture it would, I become more and more convinced of the truth of Scripture. And this is exactly how Daniel felt. The more he learned, the more committed he became to his faith. Of course, there's the danger that the opposite will take place, that Daniel and his friends may throw in the towel. Things may get difficult, and they may quit. Of course, we'll see through the course of the book this doesn't happen. But it becomes clear early in this story that God intends to give success to Daniel, and we see that happening with this little 10-day test. It's a little preview of everything else that's to come. Verses 15 and 16 skip 10 days forward to the end of this testing period, and they inform us that the boys were fatter than the other boys who ate the king's food. Fatter really doesn't mean fatter. It means healthy. It probably means the opposite of what fatter means. It means they were healthy. This is what the king was looking for. He wanted these boys to be in pristine health. So at the end of this test, it says they are fatter or they were more healthy than the other boys. Now, I don't think this is because the king's food was inherently unhealthy. It was actually probably quite good. That would be my bet. But health was never really the issue with Daniel in the first place. For Daniel, it was a matter of faithfulness to the law of Moses. And God superintended these circumstances. He made a way for Daniel and his friends to remain faithful to the covenant, even in the heart of Babylon. So we can learn from this that it is possible to live faithfully in the midst of a pagan culture. You know, if you go to seminary, sometime during those 4 years, one of the theology professors is likely to ask you to write a paper on what I call one of the gotcha events in the Old Testament. For me, it was Rahab's lie. That was the straw I drew. Some of you know what I'm talking about. In the book of Joshua, a resident of Jericho named Rahab hides two spies who had been sent out covertly on a reconnaissance mission. So they're sent out to spy out Jericho because Israelis are about to attack. So they go do a little reconnaissance, and they are staying in the home of a lady named Rahab. The men of the city find out that there are Jewish spies in Jericho, so they come looking for them at Rahab's. Word gets out. But instead of giving these men up to the men of the city, Rahab lies about their whereabouts and then sends them away in a different direction, saving their lives. So here's the question. This is why they might ask you to write a paper on this. Was Rahab's lie justified, since by telling a lie she saved the lives of the spies, or is lying always wrong? For those of you who are in seminary, doesn't that sound exactly like something you would have to deal with? Really, what's at stake here is this question: does the end justify the means? You can actually raise the same question here with Daniel. Since Daniel didn't have control over the kitchen, he didn't determine what the menu items were going to be since he's been exiled to Babylon, would it have been wrong for him to eat the food the king gave him in violation of the Mosaic law if the alternative were starvation? It's the same question, just posed in a slightly different context. Daniel doesn't engage the debate. He simply sets his mind to be obedient, and he never considers the alternative. I guess you could say that God honored his choice and made a way for him, though it might be better to say that God honored his word when Daniel chose to obey it. Let's look at verses 17 through 20. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. It's interesting when you look at this in the original Hebrew text, the word God carries the definite article. In other words, if you were translating this literally from Hebrew, this would read, "And for these four youths, the God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom." When we find the word Elohim, which is the Hebrew word for God, carrying the definite article, the God, it's usually contrasting God to something that is not authentic. So what this really means here is, as for these four young men, the true God, the real God, gave them knowledge and intelligence, and Daniel even understood visions and dreams. Verse 18. Then at the end of the days which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of them was not one person found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, or Azariah. So the four of them entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all of his realm. So these verses span the 3-year training period. The specified time of learning, the 3 years, has passed, and it's time for Daniel and his friends to stand before the king in what amounted to final exams. We've all taken finals. We get the sense here that the Chaldeans taught the classes, but it was God, the God, the true God, according to verse 17, who gave these students knowledge and intelligence to succeed. He also bestowed on Daniel a particular supernatural gift, which was the ability to interpret visions and dreams, the very thing that is needed to set Daniel apart just here in a little while in the next chapter. The Bible warns against divination. There's no question about that. But during the time before the scriptures were completed, before the canon of scripture was complete, at times God revealed things to people through visions and through dreams. And Daniel had this gift. It was a supernatural gift of interpretation. And I think there's an important lesson here, if not a warning for us, that we can learn from Daniel's 3-year Chaldean orientation class. And it's this. It actually is possible to study and function in college, even in a pagan secular university. But you better have a foundation in the Word of God before you get there. As a corollary, if and when the bottom falls out of society, it's too late to cram for finals. I've seen students approach academia in a couple of different ways. Some work hard all semester and sleep 8 hours the night before the test. Others, I guess you could say, otherwise engage themselves and stay up all night cramming for the test. Common sense will tell us which way is likely to work and which is likely to fail. And there's a parallel between academia and life in general. When the bottom falls out of life, it's too late to cram. God designed us as human beings to take in his word on a daily basis. And what we find when we do this is it prepares us for difficulties. And we don't lose our faith the first time a hard question is raised by a professor or when we encounter some difficult situation or circumstances in our lives. What Daniel and his friends faced when they stood before the king was a very serious examination. In verse 19, we read that the king talked with them. And it sounds like they just had a nice little conversation. That's not what this means at all. The Hebrew word translated talked here is the word davar. It means to speak. And it's written in what's called the PL stem. Now, some of you, if you're in seminary, will know what that means. What it means is the verb is written in a very intensive form. There are ways of writing verbs in Hebrew that intensify the meaning of the word. For example, if I take the common word katal, which means to kill, and I write that word in the PL stem, the way this particular word is written, it no longer means to kill, it means to slaughter. So here we have this word to speak or to talk, written in the PL stem, written in the intensive way. The king talked with them, but what it really means is he drilled them. This was an intense test of everything that they had learned over the last 3 years. But even under the extreme pressure of going in for this oral exam with the king, Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah outperformed the brightest and best in their class, and we're going to soon see even the brightest and best among the entire cabinet of the king's court. The text says they were 10 times better. This simply means that they performed substantially better than the other boys, and we're going to very quickly see that Daniel is going to outperform the professional scribes and astrologers of the Chaldeans. Verse 21, and Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. Cyrus came to power in 539 B.C., We're going to see here, as I'm going to talk about a dating issue here in just a moment, this is probably around 537 when he's referring to here. Think about this. Daniel comes to Babylon around 605 B.C., and he stays there at least until 537 B.C., long enough to outlast the Chaldean Empire that had captured him years earlier. I think that's significant. This is a not-so-subtle declaration that God's plan for Israel transcends anything man can do to frustrate it. If you looked at history, at the situation, at the time Daniel was taken into exile, you would conclude that there was no hope for the Jewish nation. But Daniel outlives and outlasts the Chaldean Empire. And Cyrus is mentioned for some very specific reasons, which we'll see later. The Chaldeans had been powerful enough to overthrow the Assyrians. We talked about that in depth a few weeks ago. To defeat Pharaoh Necho at the Battle of Carchemish and to destroy Jerusalem. But this boy, Daniel, no less a vegetarian of all things, outlasts the Chaldean Empire not because he was stronger than they were, but because his God had never relinquished control over history. That's the reason. Daniel offers no answer in his book to the questions, why are we here and why has this happened? For Daniel, it was simply a matter of this is God's will. And that's his answer. It's an answer that can be accepted because Daniel knows that despite what may be taking place today in his life, God will fulfill his covenant with Abraham and restore the nation. Daniel and Israel, as a matter of fact, can deal with the third year of Jehoiakim. Because even though events and circumstances are difficult, if not tragic, the first year of Cyrus is coming. The fact that the exile doesn't go on forever and that Daniel sees this situation, this terrible situation through, doesn't really give us an intellectual answer to why it happened, but it provides practical help for those living in exile. Years before, over 100 years earlier, Isaiah wrote words of encouragement to these very exiles who would be in Babylon. And here's what Isaiah said to them as a matter of encouragement. He said, "Those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. They'll mount up on wings like eagles. They'll run and not be tired. They'll walk and not become weary." These words should encourage anyone living in a time of difficulty, but they were written by Isaiah specifically to encourage the exiled Jews in Babylon in the day of Daniel. We're getting into a section in chapter 2 which is going to deal with Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. Verses 1 through 3. Now, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king gave orders to call in all the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and they stood before the king. And the king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream." Chapter 2 begins just like chapter 1 began, with a date. Chapter 1, verse 1 begins, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim." Daniel 2:1 begins, "In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar." Back on that lesson on the background to this book, I mentioned in passing that there's an apparent discrepancy between Daniel 1:1 and Jeremiah 25:1. Jeremiah, in chapter 25 of his prophecy, says that the first year of Nebuchadnezzar was the fourth year of King Jehoiakim. Daniel says the first year of King Nebuchadnezzar was the third year of King Jehoiakim. Well, there's a similar problem to this when we look at Daniel 2:1, which refers to this as the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar, when we read that in the context of Daniel 1:5. Remember Daniel 1:5? That said, the king appointed them this daily ration, and they were to be involved in this training process for how long? 3 years. Daniel 1:5 sets the term of the Chaldean education at 3 years. This is a 3-year educational process that had to be completed before Daniel could stand before the king. When we get to verses 18 and 20 of chapter 1, that records the interview or the oral exam that the king gives to these boys after 3 years of training. So at that point, back in chapter 1, Daniel has been in the king's college for 3 years when the events of chapter 1, verses 18 and 20 took place. But Daniel 2:1 says Nebuchadnezzar's dreams took place in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. So if the dreams took place after Daniel's graduation, that would have been at least 3 years after Nebuchadnezzar became king. So why does Daniel 2:1 say that the dreams happened in the second year of the king? Well, the solution to both of these apparent discrepancies is the same. And it can be complicated or it can be simple. So I'm going to opt for simple and try to explain to you why we have different dates in Jeremiah and Daniel, and why Daniel can enter school and when Nebuchadnezzar becomes king, stay there 3 years, and then be examined by him at the end of the 3 years in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Daniel's living in Babylon. When he writes this book, he's lived there at least 68 years. He's writing sometime around 537 B.C. And remember, he went there in 605. And when Daniel writes, it is common sense that tells you that he would use the traditional Babylonian method of calculation, which differed from the way kings' reigns were calculated in Judea, Jeremiah's home. Here it is. The Babylonians refer to the year that the king takes the throne as his accession year. His accession year is the year he takes the throne. This is the Babylonian system. Then they count the next year as year one. Nebuchadnezzar's coronation was September the 7th, 605 B.C. So 605, which ran through March of 604, 6 more months, was his accession year. Nebuchadnezzar's first year began on April 1st, 604 B.C. at the spring equinox, which was the Babylonian New Year. So April 1, 604 B.C. began Nebuchadnezzar's first year according to the Babylonian system. The Judeans also refer to the year that a king takes the throne as the accession year. But unlike the Babylonians, the accession year is also considered year one. So a Judean would consider April 1st, 604 B.C. to be the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's second year, not the first year as the Babylonians did. Jeremiah calculated reigns based on the Judean method. That's where he lived. he equated the fourth year of Jehoiakim with the first year of King Nebuchadnezzar. That would be 605 to 604 BC using the Judean method. But Daniel's not living under the Judean system any longer. He's been almost all of his life, since age 14, for 68 years, living in Babylon. So he uses the dating system of the culture in which he's been trained and under which he's been living, which is the Babylonian dating system, thus equating the third year of Jehoiakim with the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, which is 605 to 604 BC. Think about it this way. If I say I'm 6 feet tall, I'm not, but I could say it. If I had lived in Britain my whole life, I would tell you that I'm not 6 feet tall, I'm 1.83 meters tall. And both are correct. The difference is, which system are you using? Really, that's the bottom line. Both Daniel and Jeremiah are correct. And any attempt to see a discrepancy here is based on a misunderstanding of the way kings' reigns were dated in these two systems. So, just for one more moment, bear with me. I want to show you how this works out with regard to the specific biblical texts. Let's start with year 605 to 604. This would be September 605 through the end of March 604. With regard to Jehoiakim, the Judean king, according to Jeremiah, this would be Jehoiakim's fourth year. According to the Babylonian record, it would be his third year. Daniel's writing in Babylon, so he starts with Jehoiakim's accession year. Now, with respect to Nebuchadnezzar, according to Jeremiah, this would be Nebuchadnezzar's first year. According to the Babylonian record, under which Daniel used, this would be his accession year. This would also be Daniel's first year of training. Using the Judean dating system, these dates match Jeremiah 25:1. Using the Babylonian dating system, they match Daniel 1:1. There is no discrepancy. Let's go to the next year, 604 to 603. Again, this is going to run April through March. We're finished with Jehoiakim. With regard to Nebuchadnezzar, according to the Babylonian record, this was his first year. Regarding Daniel, this was his second year of training. Then we go to the next year, 603 to 602 BC. According to the Babylonian record, it was Nebuchadnezzar's second year. This was Daniel's third year of training. Using the Babylonian dating system, Daniel 1:5 and Daniel 2:1 match. At the end of Nebuchadnezzar's second year, according to the Babylonian record, Daniel had completed his 3 years of training and was a member of the court, albeit a junior member on the B team. So, if you're reading through here and you see something, you know, your mind just sort of clicks and says, wait a minute. 3 years in school, second year of King Nebuchadnezzar, just know there's not a problem. It is simply a matter of which dating system we're using. Verse 1 says the king had dreams. He uses the plural here. However, in verse 3, the king says, I had a dream, singular. The text also says that the dream or dreams caused the king to have insomnia. Now, I think all this took place on the same night. Some have proposed that this was a series of dreams that occurred night after night. I think this entire event occurred on one night rather than on successive nights. It appears the king awoke from his dream and he was troubled by it. Then perhaps he went back to sleep. He was awakened again, interestingly, by the same dream. Not a different dream, but the same dream, and so on throughout the night. I think this happened repetitively. This is why he could refer to a series of dreams as one dream. He dreamed this one dream several different times during the night, and each time he dreamed it, he became more upset and more troubled. This continued over the course of the night, and by the time morning came, he was in pretty bad shape. The king says that his spirit was troubled. It's a very, very, very interesting word. And I just want to spend a minute on this because I just really like this word. I think it's just phenomenal. It's the word pa'am. It's a very interesting word. It's a blended word. At least I'm using that term to describe it. It shares characteristics of a cuneiform language called Ugaritic. And in that language, it means time. And it also shares characteristics with the Phoenician cognate word, which means foot. Time, foot. As a noun, this verb can mean time, foot, or anvil. This may seem like, at least to me, an odd combination of meanings for this word. Foot, time, anvil. If you look in the poetic literature, pa'am is used to refer to the pattern of hoofbeats as a horse trots down a road. A pattern of footbeats. If you think about that imagery for a moment, you can see the connection between foot, in this case a hoof, and time, the rhythmic intervals made by a trotting horse. There's nothing more rhythmically interesting to me than the sound of a horse. It's a rhythmic sound. So here we have a connection between time, the rhythmic sound, and foot or hoof. It can also mean to walk or to take steps, that is, one after another. As a verb, it's very likely that the original meaning of pa'am was to strike, thus deriving the noun anvil. Again, the context suggests a rhythmic beating. Think of a blacksmith, if we want to use the horse analogy, he's making a horseshoe, and he's got that same rhythmic striking on the anvil, which gives a sense of time again. Rhythm and time are related. When it's written in something called the dual, which is a Semitic variation of the plural, pa'am means twice. If you write pa'am two times in a row, pa'am, pa'am, it means time on time and is used in phrases such as this, as formerly, as usual, something that we expect to repeat under certain circumstances. When the verbal form of pa'am is passive or reflexive, I'll talk about that in a minute, it means to be disturbed. I think there's actually so much more you could say about this word. It's just phenomenal. It's my favorite Hebrew word. But I think you get the idea that it's an interesting word, and it's used here in the context of King Nebuchadnezzar and how he felt during the time he's having these dreams on this particular night. So the first thing I want to point out about this verb is it's reflexive. What that means is that the king was troubled, he was disturbed, and it also suggests, reflexive means back and forth, okay? It also means that the king was adding to his own misery by whipping himself into a frenzy. We've all done this. There's a situation, we worry about it, and we begin to beat ourselves to death over it. See that? Beat ourselves to death over and over. It's this rhythmic thing. He has this dream. He's worried about it. He just continues to pound this over and over in his mind, and he works himself into a frenzy. It may be that he paced in his room. That would be another concept from this word. He walked. He took footsteps. He's pacing around in his bedroom, considering all the possible implications of his dreams. We're going to see this in this chapter in the urgency with which he addresses the Chaldeans. We'll see it in what he demanded that they do, and we'll see it in the threat that he made to them if they fail. The second thing that's interesting about this verb, and again, this is all part of how it's written in Hebrew, it's written as a causal. The king could not put the dreams out of his mind, and they continued to cause distress. If you go back to that original image of pa'am as a rhythmic beat, and that's really the sense of this word, this rhythmic beat. These dreams were occurring over and over, and they were to him like a repeating sound that he couldn't escape. And the third thing is it is written in one of the Hebrew intensive stems. We talked about kill versus slaughter a minute ago. This is written in the PL stem. It's written in the same way. So this isn't just a matter of being slightly upset. Whatever it is that's going on with the king was serious. This is not a minor disturbance. It's written in the intensive stem. It is extremely troubling to the king. I think Nebuchadnezzar calls this a dream because he didn't have a better word for it. But even though it may have come to him in the form of a dream, he took it as an omen. And it was as a very serious omen in his mind, which is why he wasted no time pulling together all of his advisors, or we might think of them as a cabinet. In verse 2, he takes action. He calls everyone he can think of together. This is his advisory staff. they're standing before the king in the palace. We're not told whether he waited till regular office hours to summon them, but somehow I don't think so. I wouldn't be surprised if after the meeting was over, these Chaldeans saw the sunrise as they were leaving. I think this became so intense during the night that he called them out of their own homes and brought them there. And they're standing before the king. This kind of brings us to what I call the who's who section of Daniel. We probably should identify the different roles of these people who made up the advisory staff of the king. We're going to see lists of people throughout this book, so it's a good idea to know who they are and what they mention. I tried to do a little summary up here if you're interested afterwards. The first group he mentions are called the magicians. Magicians in Hebrew is related to the word for stylus. Stylus. They're built off the same root. A stylus is a pen or an engraving tool, and in this day, they would take a soft clay tablet, form it into a little square, and it would be wet clay, and they would take a reed, and they would cut it at an angle, cut it at about a 60-degree angle, so that you have a point on that that they could press in different ways down into this clay and make impressions there. So the word magician and the word stylus come from the same root, which means there must be a relationship between what they do and the word for stylus. Apparently, they were a caste of religious scribes. So they were people who were responsible for keeping astrological charts. They kept records for the king. They tracked and recorded astral movements for the purpose of divination. They would have recorded charts and records on these clay tablets using this pointed reed, thus the connection of the word magician and stylus in the Hebrew language. This is the same word that's used in Genesis 41:24 of the magicians of Egypt. These are the ones who were called in to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. So they had these Egyptian counterparts who were equally incompetent. The next group are conjurers. These were occultists. That the particular word that translated conjurers means to utter or to whisper or to lisp. So these were a group of people who uttered incantations. The word comes from this word to lisp or to whisper, and they would have been involved in some sort of whispering, lisping incantations. They also practiced necromancy, which attempted to interpret mysteries through communication with the dead. The third group are called sorcerers. An alternate translation of sorcerers would be to practice someone who practices witchcraft. These, again, are occultists. This particular brand of sorcery was explicitly outlawed in Israel. In a previous lesson, I mentioned that the reforms of Josiah, as good as they were, could not remove from Israel the damage done by wicked King Manasseh. One of Manasseh's sins was this very thing, this very word. He practiced sorcery. If you look in 2 Chronicles 33, you'll find a verse that says, Manasseh made his sons to pass through the fire in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. This means he participated in child sacrifice. And he practiced witchcraft, used divination, here's our word, used sorcery, and dealt with mediums and spiritists. Then his reign is evaluated this way. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord. Last mentioned here are the Chaldeans, the Kashdim. The word is used here two different ways. It can refer to the Chaldeans, who are a people who live in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, particularly the area ruled by Nebuchadnezzar, or it can refer to an educated class of people skilled in what we might call the black arts. In function, this was a group of priests that were held over from the Babylonian Empire. And Nebuchadnezzar, as you'll remember, overran the Babylonian Empire, and he kept these priests in place, and they continued to function in that fashion. That's what this word means here. They were Chaldean or Babylonian priests. And of all the groups mentioned so far, these are the most powerful. If we were to skip down to verse 27, we would find that there is a fifth group that's not mentioned here in this original who's who. They're called the Gazrin. And that word is a participle in Hebrew, and what it means is those who cut. those who cut. If you think about an astrologer practices astrology by observing the movement of the stars. The Gazarin made their predictions by interpreting fissures that they cut into the organs of animals. So you can see that the occult was quite prevalent in Babylon. And it was these men that the king turned to try to solve this perplexing problem. It's also worth noting that this is the environment in which Daniel was placed by God. This is Daniel's work environment. These are his associates at the office. You know, we get upset sometimes if a colleague tells an off-color joke or speaks in a way that we think isn't appropriate. In all my years of working, I never observed a coworker dissecting an animal or whispering incantations. I did work with a guy once who was into astrology, but as far as I know, he didn't do any of these other things. But Daniel's expected to function in the midst of these things, and he's intended for him to do so faithfully. So, verse 3, the king has gathered these people together. He's declared to them, I have a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. A literal rendering of the king's statement is this, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. To know the dream. That phrase has caused a lot of commentators to come to the conclusion that the king forgot the dream. You know, sometimes we have a dream and we know we had a dream and we wake up and I've many times, Linda, guess what I dreamed last night? And she'll say, what? And I go, I don't know. Can't remember. I know I had a dream. I don't buy that explanation at all. This dream was such a powerful experience that I think the king remembered every single detail of this dream. His concern was not that he'd forgotten the dream, but that he didn't understand the dream. And it also teaches us that he didn't trust his advisors, which leads us to this next section, verses 4 through 11. Starting with verse 4. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we'll declare the interpretation. The king replied to the Chaldeans, The command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you'll be torn limb to limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you'll receive from me gifts and a reward of great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. In the margin of my Bible, I have written the word panic. Verse 7. They answered a second time and said, Let the king tell the dream to his servants and we'll declare the interpretation. The king replied, I know for certain that you're bargaining for time, inasmuch as you've seen the command that from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you've agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream that I may know that you can declare its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, There's not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there's no one else who could declare it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. I have a couple of comments to make about verse 4. First, I want to point out this verse marks a transition point in the book of Daniel. It marks a transition point because Daniel 2:4 through 7:28 is about the Gentile nations. Most, not all, but most of the Old Testament is about Israel. But in these next few chapters of Daniel, God is going to give us a glimpse of the future and the fates of the Gentile nations. And it's a future that we should be interested in because guess what? We live in a Gentile nation. So this next section has a lot to do with us. I'll have more to say about that, particularly as we move over later, probably next week in this chapter. So there's a shift here in verse 4 from Israel to the Gentiles, from the Jewish nation to the Gentile nations. And because Daniel is shifting his focus from Israel to the Gentiles, a very interesting thing happens in this particular verse. the language changes. When Israel's the primary object of God's revelation, he uses Israel's language, the Hebrew language. When the Gentiles are the focus, he uses a Gentile language, in this case, Aramaic. This is interesting. Verse 4, these words, "And the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, saying," are written in Hebrew. "But what they said, O king, live forever," and everything that follows this through chapter 7, verse 28, is written in Aramaic, a Gentile language. And the language changes in the middle of the sentence. Isn't that interesting? Right in the middle of the sentence. That is the point in the sentence when the shift is made from focus on Israel to focus on the Gentile nations. And from that point forward, we'll be reading, my study will be done from Aramaic, because that is the language in which this part of Daniel is written. Another interesting point is, it seems the king knows his advisors are not trustworthy, that they're not above spinning a fantasy regarding the interpretation of dreams. When the Chaldeans say to the king, "Tell us your dream and we'll declare the interpretation," let me tell you what the king hears. This is what he hears them say, and this is a paraphrase of mine. This is what the king hears. "Tell us your dream and we'll make up an interpretation that's favorable to you, O king. Then we will pray that you forget about it, since our interpretation is certain to be wrong." That's what the king hears. "Tell us the dream and we'll make up something. Then please don't hold us responsible for it, because it's just fantasy." Interpreting dreams was not an uncommon thing, and I'm pretty sure these magicians, conjurers, sorcerers, Chaldeans, and Gazarene were ready to give an interpretation to the king. This is not an issue of not being willing. The problem here is the king has thrown them a curveball. He doesn't say, "Here's my dream, tell me the interpretation." He says, "Tell me both the dream and then tell me the interpretation." He explains why. "So that I will know you're able to give me an accurate interpretation, you tell me the dream." Chaldeans know the king hasn't forgotten the dream. Otherwise, they would have made up something and then they would have given him some fantasy interpretation. They know they're being tested. There's a decree in verse 5 that's a big problem for the Chaldeans and their cohorts. "If you don't make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you'll be torn limb to limb and your houses will be made a rubbish heap." Well, he says, "Tell me the dream and what the dream means, or you'll be drawn and quartered." And I might add, "you'll be torn limb from limb" was not a metaphorical phrase. These guys, these men, without a doubt, had observed with their own eyes in this very place, in this very court, under this very king, the exact thing happen that they're being threatened with here. Of course, on the bright side, if they can do the impossible, there's great reward to be had. Verse 7, we learn that the king is not going to change his mind. Rewards aside, the Chaldeans are focused on the downside and they're not concerned with the upside. I'm willing to wager that not one of the king's advisors thinks that the risk-reward ratio here is going to work in his favor. Not one. The rewards may be great, but the downside is pretty serious. So they set out not to give him the dream and its interpretation, but to change his mind about his decree. Well, in verses 8 and 9, the king lets his advisors know that he's on to their tricks. If he gives in to their request and tells them the dream, what he'll get in return, to use his words, are lying and corrupt words. Their protests are nothing more here than an attempt to hang on to their heads for a little longer. Then finally, in verses 10 through 11, they admit their inability to do what the king has asked. And look at how they make their argument. You can tell they're lawyers. They appeal first to reality. There's no one in the world who can do this. Then they appeal to precedent. Isn't that what you do in court? Here's the precedent. "What you're asking is more than any king before you has ever asked of his advisors. There is no precedent in the ancient Near East for what you're asking." And as a last resort, they turn to theology. "Only the gods can do such things, and we aren't gods." So that brings us to verse 12, and I think we'll stop here, and we'll pick up with verse 12 and 13 next week.